As the economy improves, the federal budget deficit is growing dramatically smaller. The Congressional Budget Office has sharply revised its estimates from just a few months ago, knocking off $200 billion in borrowing. The budget projection is now $642 billion in the red. Here's NPR's John Inste.
The $642 billion deficit is still large, but far better than the trillion-dollar-plus deficits of the previous 4 years. And it lowers the relative size of the deficit to 4% of the size of the economy, down from just over 10% in 2009.
That's a lot of good news. And when it comes to the budget, we should take the good news where we can get it.
That's Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which has campaigned to reduce the federal deficit.
The problem is a lot of this comes from temporary savings, and it doesn't mean that we're on a path that's sustainable.
There are a couple of big temporary factors behind the dramatic improvement since February. One is news that mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are making big dividend payments to the government this year. The government bailed them out and took them over during the housing crisis. The second temporary factor is higher than expected tax payments from well-off taxpayers. Many sold stock and other assets late last year to avoid higher tax rates that took effect in January. Since the government's 2013 fiscal year began October 1st of last year, the taxes paid on the income from those sales will help to reduce the 2013 deficit. While McGinnis sees a temporary deficit improvement, Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a liberal think tank, has a different takeaway from the CBO report.
Well, I think when you look at it, you're really hard-pressed to see what the deficit problem is.
Baker points out that the improvement isn't just a one-year phenomenon. He notes that deficits drop through 2015 in the CBO projection and rise in the later years of the decade, largely because the CBO projects that interest rates will rise, not because of growing government spending. He argues deficits could actually be forced lower if the Congress provided some stimulus for the economy now.
If we could have a boost to growth, both short-term from boosting demand and long-term by increasing the economy's productive capacities, we're likely to be looking at a better budget situation, say, come 2020, 2021, simply because the economy will be more productive, we'll have more people working.
But that's just the kind of talk that's got deficit hawk Maya McGinnis worried. She's a little concerned that the good news will cause Washington to lose the sense of urgency it needs to deal with the longer-term deficit problems.
We still haven't dealt with the real driving fiscal challenges in our budget. The aging of the population, growing health care costs, and an outdated tax system that doesn't raise revenues in the best way that it could, that could help grow the economy even more.
Dean Baker argues that even on the health care front, there's some good news, with costs rising more slowly in recent years. McGinnis acknowledges some slowdown in health care inflation, but says it will take many more bites at the apple to get government spending on health care under control. John Inste, NPR News, Washington.
Well into the 20th century, an American working woman could be fired for getting married. That's because the role of breadwinner was reserved for husbands. That was enshrined in state laws as late as the 1970s. But since the 80s, more women than men have been graduating from college. Today, more than a quarter of married working women earn more than their spouse. And more breadwinner wives can mean more dads home with the kids. As part of our series on the changing lives of women, here's NPR's Jennifer Ludden.
A sunny spring afternoon in Alexandria, Virginia, and it's time to meet the school bus.
There we go.
Jonathan Heisegrove pops open the stroller with one hand, then expertly transfers fussy 4-month-old Zane into it. They stroll up a winding suburban block to a corner where two moms also wait. 5-year-old Egan is first off the bus with a run and a big bear hug.
Egan! What's up, buddy? Hi, how are you?
Jonathan and his wife Dawn, a public health analyst, didn't exactly plan for him to be a stay-at-home parent. They were both working full-time when Jonathan lost his job as a graphic designer 2 years ago. That also ended the company daycare. Back in their townhouse, Dawn says Jonathan stayed home full-time at first just to save money on childcare. And suddenly the world just became much calmer and quieter. And Egan wasn't as upset and he wasn't as tense anymore. And our relationship, I think, even though we were stressed about not having money, we weren't rushing around when both of us got home. And so it was just a happier place.
Jonathan agrees. He was crazed trying to balance work and kids. He talks while cradling baby Zane, bouncing on a large blue ball to try and get him to sleep.
I missed out on doing this kind of thing. I would do it, but I would be too worried about work to be able to really focus on my child at that point.
Dawn was surprised and happy to discover two colleagues whose husbands are also stay-at-home dads. But when I ask if she feels she's missing out on anything, I don't even finish the sentence before she's nodding her head.
Like, I showed up for the preschool graduation and they all looked at me like, who are you? And I kind of felt like the bad mom moment. Like, he's got the Dad of the Year award and I'm kind of sitting on the sidelines a little bit.
More hurtful is when even family members don't quite get their choice. When paying a dinner bill once, Jonathan's dad chastised him for spending your wife's money. And Dawn's younger brother recently wondered why she doesn't just tell her husband to get a job. Jonathan says societal expectations have not kept pace with their reality. He sees it out shopping with the kids.
I get the, oh, look, it's a dad. Oh, that's so sweet. And my own assumptions are saying, yeah, they just think it's just one day.
Still, he's found people who can relate at the Wednesday morning playgroup of DC Metro Dads.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Just one.
The front hall of this home in Arlington, Virginia is lined with shoes, backpacks, strollers.
The first time I got here and saw 15 other dads, I was kind of blown away.
Carl Nelson is standing in the kitchen, six-month-old Jack tucked under one arm, football style. Before discovering this, his only organized social outlet had been a mother's playgroup, which he still goes to now and then.
I generally look for another conversation when it steers toward summer swimwear. However, you know, discussion of nursing and other issues, I'm perfectly comfortable with. I get to see those details on a daily basis with my wife. So I've actually participated in those conversations in a productive way.
On the hair.
The host of this get-together used to be a workaholic in the tech industry. But Mark Bildner says losing his parents changed his attitude. He's been a full-time dad by choice for 5 years now and is proud to have helped his wife advance her career.
She took a position at her company that involved a lot of travel, last-minute work, late nights, and so forth. And I have some understanding of how it feels to be in that position, so I try to be as supportive as I can.
Men today are now reporting higher levels of work-family conflict than women are.
Stephanie Kuntz is with the Council on Contemporary Families. She says men's ideals have shifted closer to what many women have long felt.
Not just pressure, but desire to be more involved in family life, in childcare and housework and cooking. And at the same time, all of the polls are showing that women are now just as likely as men to say that they want to have challenging careers.
The census finds fewer than 4% of stay-at-home parents are dads, though that has doubled in a decade. But Kuntz says the number's vastly underreported. It doesn't include the many men who do some work but are still their children's primary caregiver, a trend that cuts across class and income.
The place there you see the greatest sharing of childcare, interestingly enough, is in blue-collar and union workers who often work split shifts and then trade off the childcare.
So what of the contention that so heats up the blogosphere that women are somehow better suited to manage house and home? Kuntz will have none of it. For 150 years, she says, men have been trained not to detect dirt on the floor or a child's needs.
So we really have to make an effort to let the other person succeed at something they've never done before and to give them the chance to get comfortable with it.
That's right.
Back home, changing Zane's diaper, Jonathan Heisegrove does indeed coo, smile, and baby talk with the best of them.
Wah, 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 wah. Ah, nah, 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 nah.
He says the impact of what he's doing struck him one day when a college kid in the neighborhood stopped his car and rolled down the window. He told Jonathan, I wish my father had played with me as much as you play with your son.
And it became another point in my development as a stay-at-home dad that, okay, this is really important and people see it.
I think it already is changing. Every time we interact with somebody, we're changing their perception of what is appropriate gender roles or parenting roles.
By the time their boys grow up and have kids, they say, maybe, just maybe, no one will be talking about that at all. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
And there is much more from our series on the changing lives of women online.
Our She Works sign generator has over 1,000 submissions illustrating various approaches women have for operating the workplace. One says, no is a complete sentence.
Another, no is not an option.
There's don't bring in baked goods if you want the corner office.
And there's more to life than work. You can see those for yourself and make your own sign at npr.org/sheworks. More now on those automatic federal spending cuts known as the sequester. The actual impact of those cuts can be as hard to predict as, say, a hurricane, which means several challenges for government forecasters. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration won't release its official forecast for the hurricane season until next week, but other meteorologists are already predicting numerous storms. The question is whether the sequester will deal its own blow to government forecasters just as they're dealing with a busy hurricane season. From Miami, here's NPR's Greg Allen.
It was just a few days before Halloween last year, and director of the National Hurricane Center, Rick Knabb, was doing his best to send a message to residents in the northeastern U.S.
Don't focus too much on the fact that this could become a post-tropical system before making landfall. That's not going to change the fact that this large system, Sandy, very capable of producing several life-threatening hazards over a very large area.
As it turned out, Superstorm Sandy ended up as the second costliest hurricane in U.S. history, and it followed much the same path as Hurricane Irene a year earlier. Together, the two events are a reminder that hurricanes are a threat to the Gulf and the entire East Coast. In Florida, a state used to preparing for and responding to hurricanes, the state's governor, Rick Scott, recently flagged another issue, the budget cuts ordered to federal agencies as part of sequestration.
My biggest concern is that while they say sequestration will stop during a disaster, are they going to be ready in the meantime? Are they going to have an impact on our National Guard? Are they going to impact on our training, things like that?
Florida's National Guard says about half of its 2,000 full-time personnel will have to take 4 furlough days, most likely during hurricane season. The head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Craig Fugate, says sequestration will cut $1 billion from his agency's budget. Fugate spoke at a recent conference of emergency management groups in Fort Lauderdale.
And I'm not going to tell you FEMA's going to do more with less money. What I am going to tell you is we're going to probably do fewer things, but we're going to do them better.
Fugate said after a disaster, that means not duplicating efforts of the states and the private sector. After Sandy, for example, when millions were without electricity and gas, it was the power companies and service stations that provided much-needed relief. At the National Weather Service, employees will have to take 4 furlough days this summer. Dan Sobian, the head of the union representing National Weather Service workers, says the furloughs come on top of a hiring freeze that has cut the agency's workforce by almost 10%.
It has left many offices around the country, not all, but many offices around the country severely understaffed to the point where some of the functions they do just aren't going to get done.
Miami's National Hurricane Center, for example, is short-staffed in its information technology division. Personnel that are vital in getting hurricane forecasts and warnings on the web and out to the media and the public. For forecasters and researchers, including those who staff the Hurricane Hunter flights, the furloughs are expected in July and August, just as the storm season is ramping up. Hurricane Center Chief Rick Knabb says furloughs will be canceled if a storm develops. But Sobian is skeptical. He says storms often develop with very little notice.
You usually don't have 3 or 4 days, the amount of time it would take to do an administrative action to cancel somebody's furlough and bring them back to work. You usually don't have that kind of time to call somebody in because the weather's getting bad.
FEMA Chief Fugate says his agency has enough money to cover aid promised to individuals affected by Superstorm Sandy. Less clear is how much FEMA has for state and local governments still working to rebuild from the storm. And that doesn't begin to address the potential threat and the costs of another active hurricane season. But at the recent hurricane conference, Fugate had advice for emergency managers who think things may be different this year because of budget constraints. Victims of a disaster, he said, don't care.
They don't want to hear your excuses, and they don't want to hear how bad your day was or how much your budget got caught. Because when they lost their family, they lost their homes, they just want to know that government and the rest of the team's there for them.
A commitment that may be tested if this hurricane season is anything like last year's. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Japan's economy is finally getting a lift. The stock market is soaring there. Companies like Toyota and Sony are seeing a surge in profits. And today, Japan's government reported the economy grew at a 3.5% annual rate in the first 3 months of the year, a significant improvement. Now, the government has prodded growth by causing the value of the currency, the yen, to decrease against other currencies like the dollar. That affects the price of everything Japan buys and sells, for example, dropping the price of Japanese exports. And now analysts fear that could fuel a currency war. NPR's John Itzde has our business bottom line.
The dramatic shift in Japanese policy has sent the value of the country's currency tumbling around 30% since last September. Last week, it crossed the 100 yen to the dollar mark, a level not seen in 4 years. That's made Japanese products cheaper in global markets and has competitors around the world howling for relief. C. Fred Bergston, Director Emeritus of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says that includes U.S. industries, most notably U.S. auto companies.
They've been urging the Congress, for example, to oppose Japan's coming into the new Trans-Pacific Partnership trade negotiations with the U.S. They've said they'll oppose that big trade agreement across the Pacific if Japan is in it without rectifying the currency problem.
The value of the yen is falling because the Bank of Japan is flooding the country's economy with huge amounts of cash. And some of Japan's other big competitors, like South Korea, have threatened to devalue their own currencies in response. But Bergston says Japan's current policy is defensible. He says unlike China's manipulation of its currency, Japan's stimulus policy is aimed at boosting its internal growth, not grabbing market share from foreign competitors.
If Japan gets back on track through expanding domestic demand, getting consumption going, getting private investment in Japan up, and that does increase their imports, spills over to the rest of the world, has a favorable effect.
But Bergston says it could also end badly. If Japan simply takes advantage of the devalued yen to boost its own growth by exporting more, it will be a negative for the global economy. Economist Richard Koo of the Nomura Research Institute has spent the past several years analyzing the effects of massive central bank intervention in the U.S. and Europe. He says the Bank of Japan's huge quantitative easing, which is at about twice the level of the Federal Reserve's, does appear to be having positive effects inside Japan, including a 50% boost in the Japanese stock market in the past 6 months.
This rise in the stock market definitely is producing positive results for the Japanese economy. People are feeling much more confident about the future. Yen is weaker, and so companies are finally beginning to say, maybe we can compete in this world after all.
But, Koo says, the central bank's efforts will fail if they're not combined with other measures being pushed by Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. They include government spending on infrastructure, market-opening reforms in the country's economy, and investment incentives for Japanese companies. They've been unwilling to borrow and invest for the past 20 years, he says, despite 0% interest rates. That's because the companies overborrowed during Japan's stock market and real estate bubble years and lost big when the bubble burst.
And that's just like the Americans after the Great Depression. Those Americans who lived through the Great Depression never wanted to borrow money after that because of the traumatic experience they went through in the 1930s. We have a mini version of that in Japan. Even though the balance sheets are clean, bankers are willing to lend, interest rates lowest in history, companies are not borrowing money.
Koo says markets could collapse again when the central banks around the world finally reverse course and begin pulling money out of the economy to keep inflation in check. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.